Welcome to Sparks of History, where Jewish history and world history meet. We are very pleased to have with us today Rabbi Dr. Gil Perl. Rabbi Perl is a noted speaker, educator, and scholar. Dr. Perl earned his master's and PhD degrees from Harvard University and received rabbinical ordination from Reitz Yeshiva University. Rabbi Perl served as the head of school at Kohelet Yeshiva in suburban Philadelphia, and as Chief Academic Officer of the Kohelet Foundation. Currently, Rabbi Perl is the CEO of the Addis Family Foundation and the founding head of the Jewish Leadership Academy in the Miami area. In his writings and lectures, Rabbi Perl tackles a wide range of topics, including history of modern Jewry, contemporary Jewish education, and modern Orthodoxy. Today, we will be discussing a fascinating subject and book, The Pillar of Volozhin, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, and the World of 19th Century Lithuanian Torah Scholarship. It is an insightful book, and urge all of our viewers and listeners, as I did, to go onto Amazon, click of a button, delivered straight to your home, free delivery. And Rabbi Dr. Perl, again, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
To get started, a little bit about your background and how you became interested in Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Berlin and Lithuanian Torah scholarship.
Yeah, sure. My background, I came through it as probably the a rather standard modern Orthodox track growing up in Bergen County. Frisch spent 2 years in Israel following graduation post high school. And that, the truth of the matter is that's really where my interest was peaked. I was a student at Yeshivat Har Etzion and was looking for something to sink my teeth into around, Parshat Shavua. And somebody suggested that I perhaps try Ha'amik Davar, which was pretty new to me then. That is the Netziv's Perush on Chumash. And I started learning it and was really pretty fascinated by what I saw. Continued at it even post yeshiva as an undergraduate student. I think what piqued my interest most was a distinct sense of something very modern, very creative in his work. And, while I was no expert in Jewish history at the time, I certainly had an interest. And the little that I knew, this was a Perush on Chumash that emerged from Eastern Europe in the 19th century from a small shtetl called Volozhin, written by people who were not Western educated, they weren't university educated. There wasn't anything modern about the world that this had come from, at least as far as I knew. And yet there seemed to be something distinctly modern, creative, different about the content of what he was writing. And that just continued to kind of pique my interest, my imagination, to the point that I got to graduate school and kind of had the opportunity to really sink my teeth into it and ask, the big questions about what was going on there and what was it that I was seeing and what wasn't I seeing, about the context from which this emerged.
Just briefly, what was the state of Lithuanian Jewry in the early 1800s? Set the scene a bit.
Sure. Much of Eastern European Jewry goes through a very rocky time in the second half of the 18th century. Right. This is the period that sees the great disputes emerge between the rise of Hasidus and the backlash, particularly in the Lithuanian community, against what they saw as sort of a new form of traditional Judaism, a new hierarchy of values. This is the period in which the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth ceases to exist and now becomes part and parcel of the Russian Empire. And that sparks a whole other set of kind of questions from a political standpoint of what does Russia do with its Jews, that an entire population that it now inherited, or didn't inherit, kind of conquered. So it's a, the end of the 19th century, the 18th century is a period of, I think, a good degree of flux, a good degree of uncertainty for much of the Jewish community in the Polish-Lithuanian, was the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. In Lithuania in particular, there is, you know, less of an openness to Hasidus, which by the turn of the 19th century and certainly over the course of the early 19th century is really going to come to dominate much of what was Poland, and even large swaths of what was Central Europe, but really doesn't find fertile soil in the Lithuanian world quite the same way. What you have in those first decades of the 19th century, so is actually a return to some stability, actually, because they are now under the rule of the Russian Tsars. The Russian Tsars, although Catherine the Great herself, who was really responsible for the partition of Poland, was actually quite benevolent to, she saw herself as an enlightened despot and was actually quite benevolent to the Jewish community initially. Those who succeed her, particularly Alexander the First, who is the Tsar for the first quarter of the 19th century, and then Nicholas the First, who takes over after him, replaces him, and is the Tsar for the next quarter of the 19th century. They both have this need to do something about the Jewish question. So there are a whole bunch of different approaches they take towards what they call Russification to try and make the Jewish community more Russian. And none of them tend to work terribly well, but the flip side of that is that they are quite powerful in their rule, and that creates a certain sense of stability that things are the way they are. They're not going to be changing really quite, much again. And when there is political stability, there tends to be some, cultural flourishing in the Jewish community. So from a political standpoint, things weren't great, but things were actually, I think, a little bit better in terms of the stability, at least, that the Jewish community faced. What's interesting about the first half of the 19th century, though, is that this, as I said a moment ago, Hasidus doesn't really penetrate into the Lithuanian world. I mean, it's there, they know about it and they see it, but the masses are not, haven't really adopted it. So it's pre-Hasidus, or it's not Hasidus. It's also pre the rise of the yeshiva movement. 1803 is the founding of the Volozhner yeshiva. And then in 1815, there will be a similar yeshiva founded in Volozhin, in Mir. But it's not until the middle of the 19th century that these institutions really begin to dominate the landscape and the cultural landscape of Lithuanian Jewry. So it's pre the real rise of the yeshiva movement. It's also pre-Haskalah. That's something that we often get wrong, and that the movement for Jewish enlightenment in Western Europe is very much in full force. And by the end of the 18th century, the beginning of the 19th century, that's a movement that's well underway. It does not really penetrate into Eastern Europe until the middle of the 19th century. It's the second half of the 19th century that sees a rise in the influence of Haskalah. So you have a period of, 30, 40 years in the first half of the 19th century that isn't, where there's political stability and there's some cultural flourishing, but there isn't quite a yeshiva movement yet. There isn't Hasidus and there isn't Haskalah. And that really is much where my book focuses on what was happening in this really interesting world of Lithuanian rabbinic scholarship in this first half of the 19th century.
Just again, to set the scene, some of the biographical milestones of the early years of Nitziv, and when and how did Nitziv become head of the yeshiva in Volozhin?
Sure. So the Nitziv was born in 1816. It's also, if you look it up, it says 1817, but it's a confusion around the Hebrew dates and the secular dates. So it was November 20th, 1816. And he's born to a fairly prominent family in the city of Mir, a small, you know, shtetl in what is today Belarus. His family both has rabbinic roots to it. His mother comes from the Eisenstadt family, which is a well-known rabbinic family, traces its roots back to, you know, Rav Meir of Eisenstadt, who was the author of the Panim Meiros and others along the way. I mean, his father was a successful merchant. So he really brought the two worlds of both financial success and Torah learning together. And that's probably most obvious in the fact that his kids are, you know, have very good shidduchim made for them. And it was not the only one. But, you know, his sister famously is, you know, gets married to Yerichiel Michalat Levi Epstein, who's, you know, the author of the Aruch HaShulchan. But the young Naftali is, he's born and raised in Mir. He's educated there. We don't know much about his education. We assume he learned with his father. We assume that maybe that the rabbis of the town, which also kind of related to the Eisenstadt family, were involved in his early education. But what we know is that at the age of 14, a marriage is arranged for him to the daughter of Rav Itzela of Volozhin. Rav Itzela of Volozhin is the son of Rav Chaim of Volozhin, who takes over for Rav Chaim of Volozhin as the Rosh Yeshiva in the Yitz Chaim Yeshiva in Volozhin. So she is 13, he is 14 when this marriage is arranged, and he leaves home in order to marry her and then become a student in the yeshiva. In terms of where and how things proceed from there, there's kind of the lore, and then there's what we know in terms of the actual facts. The lore, and I always hate saying this publicly because there are so many good and important messages that are often conveyed when people give over the story of the Nitziv as having been, quote unquote, as of average intelligence, you know, and someone who's sort of climbed his way to the top through tremendous hasmada and work. And, and there's a variety of stories that are told around this theme. I hesitate because I think all the messages are really good and important. As an educator, I want to give them over to my own students. I just don't think they're true when it comes to the Nitziv. The reasons I don't think they're true is, there are a number of them. But first of all, you know, a young boy of average intelligence, a Shlemazel, would not have a marriage arranged for him, you know, at the age of 14 to the daughter of Rav Itzela of Volozhin. Case closed. It wouldn't happen. He would not marry off his daughter to somebody who didn't have tremendous potential as a Talmid Chacham. But beyond that, we actually have a pretty reliable account. A man by the name of Max Lilienthal, who is a Western German Jew who is in Russia, who begins actually to work for the Russian government in trying to further Russify or modernize the Jewish community in Russia. It's a mission he has that he fails terribly at, and actually has to leave Russia and comes to Cincinnati here in the States. And actually, once he does, he publishes a travel account of his travel through the Palo settlement and the various communities that he visited. And in that is an account of him coming to Volozhin. And he relates that in 1841, he comes to Volozhin, and Rav Itzela is an old man at the time. And he notes that Rav Itzela has him take, that it's a young man named Hirschleib, his son-in-law. Hirschleib is obviously Yiddish for Naftali Tzvi, who is assigned the duty of taking Max Lilienthal around, and he's referred to as one of the greatest Talmudists in all of Russia at the age of 1841. And we also know he's also it notes in that same account that he's already been appointed to give shiurim in Volozhin already, and he's 25 years old. Right? So either he went from being a schlemazel at the age of 13 and 14, and over the course of, you know, 10 years has had this incredible epiphany and is now at the age of 25, one of the greatest Talmudists in all of Russia, or there was something there all along, you know, but that wasn't possibly, you know, recognized by all or understood by all. But we know by 1841, he's already giving shiurim in Volozhin. Ravitzla dies in 1849, and it's actually his older son-in-law, Rabbi Eliezer Yitzhak Fried, who is appointed to replace him at Rosh Yeshiva. He passes away rather young, only 4 years later. And so in 1853, at the age of 36, the Nisi was appointed Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin. And as many people know, that his appointment wasn't uncontested. There were actually two attempts to contest his appointment, one by Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, probably the most famous. Rav Yosef Ber was initially appointed to be his number two in command, the other by Yehoshua Heschel Levin, both of whom have direct family links to Rav Chaim of Volozhin. The Nisiv has married into the family. The other two had direct family links. Each time a kind of a Beis Din was assembled to try and determine, you know, whether there was any legitimacy to the claim, and in both accounts, the Nitziv, you know, his stake and his claim to being the Rosh Yeshiva was just solidified. And so from 1853 until 1891, he is the Rosh Yeshiva of the largest yeshiva in the world. This is the Volozhin at its height during the years that he is its Rosh Yeshiva. He doesn't travel very much. He doesn't leave. He doesn't go very far. He goes to Vilna on occasion. But he, in 1891, he's actually forced to close the yeshiva. He's also very sick. In 1892, he traveled to Warsaw to get medical treatment. And then in 1893, he passes away there in Warsaw. So those are kind of the major points in his kind of life story.
Before we get into the specifics of the one of his works, the Emek HaNetziv, what were the major works that the Netziv produced?
Yeah, so people today generally know the Netziv by his Pirush HaChumash, HaMek Davar. That is not what the Netziv considered to be his magnum opus. The Netziv was, and he writes very clearly about it, his life work, the thing he was most proud of, was his perush on the She'iltos of Rabbi Chaigon, you know, known as HaAmik She'ela. This was a massive commentary on this Gaonic halachic work that he published in his own lifetime. He was published it from the years 1861 to 1867. He had been working on it for years and years beforehand. And it is it's a tour de force. It's an incredible work that really stems to, it uses the work of the She'iltos as an entry point into understanding much of what happens in the Rishonim, whether it's, you know, Rishonim and their commentary on various areas of Shas, or it's halachic positions that the Rambam or others have taken. He believes that we understand much of how these positions amongst the Rishonim developed and were taken by looking back at an earlier work, you know, from the Gaonim, in this work of Rabbi Chaigon. In, you know, late in his life, his Pirush HaChumash was published. They were really, that really is a compilation of shiurim that he gave. One of the things that made the Netziv unique was that he would give a chumash shiur on a daily basis. He gave it, you know, every week. It was on Parashas HaShavua. But notes were taken, and he himself had notes from each of those shiurim, and those were compiled under his tutelage and his supervision into what is known as the Amek Davar, which is a 5-volume commentary on Chumash. Also in his lifetime, he published a Perush called Rina Shel Torah, which is primarily a parish on Shir HaShirim, but it also has this incredible essay that's appended to it, really about the roots of anti-Semitism, really fascinating and continues to be, I think, a very relevant and interesting read. The Netziv did this. He wrote, in addition to his commentarial work, he would write very large introductions. Or, you know, in this case, it wasn't an introduction. There is an introduction to the Shir HaShirim, but this is an appendage too. But his introduction, for example, to Halamek She'ila, known as Kidma Sa'emek, is pretty much a work in and of itself. It's a quasi history of the intellectual history of Torah Sheba'al Peh. And it's a long piece, sort of tracing the different types of Torah study that that happened over the course of time and how they developed. His introduction to Amek Davar is also a work in and of itself that deserves to be studied. But those are the works that he published during his lifetime, as well as a parish on the Haggadah. He obviously was a major posig, and he wrote, you know, innumerable letters and shalos and shuvos. Those were collected. He knew that they were being collected late in his own lifetime. He reluctantly gave his approval for them to be collected and published, but they were published posthumously under the title Meishiv Davar. So we have Amik She'ela on Shiltos, we have Amik Davar on Chumash, we have Rina Shel Torah on Shir HaShirim, and Meishiv Davar. Those are all the things that he really gave his approval to publishing. Many, many years later, we're talking now about, so he passed away in 1893, we're talking about half a century later, beginning in the 1950s, his descendants will begin publishing other works that he wrote. Amongst them are the Merome Sada, which is his parish on certain Masechtos, in Shas. It's his parish on the Sifrei that you mentioned before, Emek HaNetziv, as well as a commentary on Mechilta, and also what we would call notes, not a full commentary on Toras Kohanim as well. So that's his literary output.
I guess we can now dive into Emek HaNetziv, which is what the Pillar of Elazhin focuses on. You had mentioned it now. So when exactly was it written? It was published much later. And how did it fit in with traditional Torah scholarship of that time when it was written?
Yeah, so you know what? Let me maybe just go back to kind of the story of, and I'll tell you sort of how did I land on Emek HaNetziv, of all things that the Netziv published. Why did I focus on that? So as I said, you know, at the outset, I had this fascination with Amek Davar, not with Emek HaNetziv. I didn't know really Emek HaNetziv existed. In my earlier years, an earlier fascination with the Netziv, I was fascinated with Amek Davar. And I was fascinated particularly by this question of where did this come from? Right? Why was there something in here that really seemed to be incredibly, again, for lack of a better word, modern or creative and out of the box, not something you would imagine coming from the Rosh Yeshiva of the largest traditional Lithuanian yeshiva in the world. It would never come right from that world. So what was different? Where did this come from? And as a graduate student, as a student studying history, so I was now at this point sort of wondering, well, what clues do we have, you know, as to what could have given him this kind of perspective. And so the first thing you want to do is look at the work itself. So again, my interest was in Hamek Davar. So I'm looking at Hamek Davar for clues as to what could have influenced this work and produced, you know, what I was reading. And particularly, I was interested in what sources is he citing, right? I mean, perhaps he's citing works that he was reading that were influential on him, that were more of this, you know, sort of out of the box type of source, and that would have explained, you know, at least some of it. But you can read Hamek Davar up, you know, front, back, up and around, and you're really not going to find anything that he cites in Hamek Davar that is, you know, out of the ordinary. There's one citation, and I almost every year somebody emails me about this. There's a, you know, when the discussion of Moshe's name, he cites sort of Shmuel Mibehaim, who has an interesting, almost critical, academic critical approach to it. And people always want to know who Shmuel Mibehaim is, and I tried, and I don't know. That's the answer. I do not know. I spent some time on it years ago. I haven't gone back to it recently. I don't know the answer. But other than that, the Nesiv cites Chazal. He cites the Rishonim. He cites his father-in-law, his grandfather-in-law, and he cites the Gra. And that's pretty much it. There's nothing in the work that suggests that he was reading anything outside of that. So then my next step was to sort of figure out, well, okay, so if there's nothing here, well, maybe there are citations of what he was reading somewhere else. And ultimately what I wanted to do was I wanted to get back to I was interested in the earliest things that he was reading, right? Let me go back. Can I reconstruct his education in some way? And maybe that will shine some light on the output even later in his own life. And so, I first started working on Amik She'ela, and then through Amik She'ela realized that actually, at least the way he was recounting in his own writing, it seems that his Perush on Sifrei was the earliest thing that he wrote. And so I spent a good amount of time just trying to validate that claim, that in fact, Emek HaNetziv, his Perush on the Sifrei, is the earliest thing he was working on. It's the work of his youth. He'd started it certainly in his early 20s, but probably even in his late teens, he was already working on this Perush, on this, the halachic medrash of the Sifrei. And, once I understood that that's really his earliest work, I dove into that. And what I found was really pretty startling. I found that unlike in Emek, in Amik Davar, in Emek HaNetziv, the Netziv is citing left and right what he is reading, and it is very far from the traditional canon of what you would expect, and certainly what comes out later in the 19th century from the traditional world of the yeshiva, for example, the Netziv in his Perush on the Sifrei is quoting from works of Hebrew grammar written by Karaites, that he has no problem, citing and telling you to go and read. He's citing people like Moses Mendelssohn, right? Naftali Herzweisel, who works with Mendelssohn in his Perush on Chumash. He's citing somebody like Levita, Eliyahu Levita, who wrote a work called Tishbi, and a work called Mesoret HaMesoret. And these are Renaissance works that were somewhat controversial in their time. Levita is the first one to suggest, for example, that the Tamei HaMikra didn't come from Sinai, and that they were added in later on. And the Netziv has no problem, citing them. He's also citing works of Jewish philosophy, Kuzari, Mor Nevuchim, Sefer Ikarim, Akedas Yitzchak, amongst others, which of course is not terribly controversial, but it's very different, right, than what comes out of your traditional Talmud scholarship in the second half of the 19th century. He's also reading newspapers, and he cites the Maskilic newspapers of his day in this Perush. And so that was the big first revelation, that I had, that he in fact was reading just about everything he could get his hands on, and doesn't seem to have any compunction, telling his readership that he is reading these things, and suggesting that they go and read it themselves. Probably the most interesting amongst those is a citation of Azariah de Rossi, which we can talk about as well. But it was this revelation that he in fact was reading quite broadly. That was sort of my first aha, and I actually remember coming back to my thesis advisor and telling him, you know, so my grand quest is now done. You know, I wanted to know what was the initiative reading. I wanted to understand where all this creativity and sort of out of the box stuff came from. And now I can, you know, I can give you a list of his library. He was reading all sorts of interesting things. And now I understand where it came from. I said to him, you know, it seems that the Nitziv was reading quite a bit underneath his Gemara, you know, as a young student. And to which my thesis advisor said to me, how do you know it was under the Gemara? Which was a great question. You know, in other words, he pushed me to ask, well, was this unique? You know, was this different? Is the Nitziv doing something, you know, that bucks the norm in the early 19th century? Or maybe this was actually the norm. And that's what forced me to sort of take a Nitziv and now put it into its context of other works that are being published around a similar time, and found that in fact it does belong to a whole genre of works that we don't know terribly well today. But they tend to be works on Medrash. So for example, when you open your standard Vilna Medrash Rabbah today, almost all of the commentaries around the side of the page come from the first half of the 19th century in Lithuania. They were reading, Medrash was a major focus of study, both Medrash Halacha, Medrash Haggadah, and Emek HaNitziv was part of that. You know, he was part of that world, and that's part of what he was interested in studying. And many of these works share many of the sort of central features of Emek HaNitziv, amongst them a focus on Pshat, a focus on emending the text. You know, both things which the influence of the Gra is very clear, right, in these works. Many of them also share this kind of intellectual breadth of citing really interesting works without any hesitation. There's also, interestingly, a format that a lot of them share in the dual commentary, which we know, the dual or triple commentary we probably know best from the Mishnah Berurah. Right, that it has multiple pieces, all written by, you know, by the same author. That's a legacy. The Mishnah time is obviously also a product of 19th century Lithuania. He's very much on the end of that world, but that comes from earlier in the 19th century, where this was the standard way of writing. You would have a main text, you a main commentary, and then you would write a secondary commentary where you would elaborate, where you would put in almost footnotes. And that was pretty much standard amongst all these Medrash commentaries, and it's true in Emek HaNitziv as well. And the other really interesting thing I found was a penchant for poetry, believe it or not. You know, many of these works have introductory poetry at the beginning or at the end, which is something we often associate with, you know, Spain in the Middle Ages. But there it is amongst the rabbinic elite of early 19th century Lithuania, including the Nitziv, writing rhyming poetry to introduce and to close their work. So that, in brief, is what Emek HaNitziv is, and why I landed up, you know, focusing there.
What was there something that propelled the Nitziv and the other writers' focus on Medrash and commentaries on Medrash during that period? Was it a reaction to something? Were they trying to get a certain point across? Why was that a commonality in that part of Jewish history?
Yeah, so I have a few theories on this. One is sort of a lofty, you know, theoretical idea, and the other is perhaps a much more practical, less highfalutin thought on this. So the lofty one goes like this. I think you could actually trace an arc of commentary that follows almost the hierarchy of authority in halachic texts. That is, our earliest commentaries tend to focus, right, on the text of the Bavli itself, right? That is our most authoritative halachic text. Right? And out of that emerges both our, you know, our the Perushim that we have on it, as well as the halachic you know, codes, which starting with the Rif, you know, and the Rambam and the Tur, all try to codify for us what it's found there in the Bavli. I don't want to oversimplify it and say that that's, you know, was saturated, but I think by the time you get to the 18th century, there's kind of this desire to say, all right, well, what's next, right? What's next after we have so much commentary today already on the Bavli. I think it's interesting to note that the 18th century is where we begin to have commentary on the next rung, which would be the Rishonim, right? In terms of halachic hierarchy. And so our great works on the Rishonim emerged from the 18th century. And I think by the time we get to the 19th century, we're almost ready for that next rung down, which is the rest of the material of Chazal, which is found in places like, you know, our Midrashim and Tosefta, and our earliest Gaonic works like the She'iltos. Now, for sure, some of this was the Vilna Gaon, right? It's the influence of the Vilna Gaon, because the Vilna Gaon clearly wrote on all of these things. He amended all of these texts. He was interested in sort of the broad canon of Chazal, you know, completely. But I think there's a progression there that can be traced, you know, that lands us in the beginning of the 19th century, post Yerushalmi. Now let's look at the rest of Chazal. There is also a very definite reality that these texts are more accessible in the early 19th century. You have a real boom in the printing industry, in the Jewish Hebrew printing industry in Eastern Europe, in the decades from 1780 to 1820, I believe you have 43 new printing houses that emerge in Eastern Europe between the years 1780 and 1821, compared to six that emerged in the 80 years prior to that. So there's, when you have new printing houses, they need new material, right, to put out there, and so these works become accessible. But the other piece that I think it very much ties into the specific focus on Medrash is has to do with the position of Magid. This is something I touch upon a little bit in my book as well. Many of the Pirushim that are written by people who hold this position of Magid, or Magid Meisharim, which I think is also a position that's not so well understood today. It's often associated, I think, with storytelling, you know, itinerant preaching, which was true in some areas of Eastern Europe. But what's often lost is that the Magid was actually the predominant public intellectual of the time, before the rise of the yeshivas, before you have, you know, a Rosh Yeshiva. The dominant public intellectual in Eastern European life was the Magid. He was the person who spoke on a regular basis, right? Your Rav of the town spoke twice a year, and Shabbos HaGadol and Shabbos Shuvah. The person who would give shiurim, who would educate the masses, whether it was, you know, halacha or more often than not it was machshava, it was musar, would be the magid. If you were a big town, you'd have a permanent magid. This was his job. And not only that, but the magid generally, the position of magid generally came along with a position on the town's based it. So this was a first rate Talmud Chacham. So Vilna has a magid. Famously, the Malbim tried out to be the magid of Vilna, and he didn't make it. But so that these magidim are speaking on a regular basis, usually Shabbos afternoon. If you're a smaller town and you can't afford to have your own magid, there were itinerant magidim who would come in. They'd come, you know, go town to town. Shabbos, you'd stop on the, you know, on the shulchan in Shabbos morning, you'd say such and such a magid that's here is going to give a shiur this afternoon. But so at the end of the day, these magidim need chomer ledrush. They need what to speak about, right? And often their material is intended to be inspiring, and it's intended to, you know, to really provoke the imagination and engage their audiences. And so Medrash becomes a place to look in order to do that. And I think that very much ties in to the rise in popularity of Medrash during this time.
You had mentioned, of course, Azaria DeRossi. Who was he? Why was he controversial? How did the Netziv utilize him? You know, today when you read even a Torah article, whatever level it's on, people, rabbis, writers are always quoting secular sources to get a point across. It's common today, you know, but why was he controversial as a source for someone like the Netziv? Who was he? Why controversial?
Okay, so let's sort of reframe that and say he wasn't controversial, right, in his time. That's my argument in the book. Actually wasn't controversial, which makes it so interesting, right? Today we would see him as potentially controversial. But what's so fascinating is that he doesn't seem to have been controversial at all. So who was Azaria DeRossi? Azaria DeRossi was a 16th century Italian Jewish scholar. And he writes a book called Sefer Ma'orei Naim in 1573. And the book is actually really an amalgamation of three different works, one called Hadras Zakenim, one called Kol HaLokim, and the other Imrei Bina. And it's really the third one that gets the most focus. Azaria DeRossi was very much a product of Renaissance Italy and many of the intellectual, currents of his time, which is the beginnings of a more kind of scientific look at history and at texts. And so Azaria DeRossi in his Sefer Ma'orei Naim advocates a hermeneutical stance, a stance towards rabbinic literature that kind of limits its authoritative nature to areas of halacha, and argues that once Chazal are getting outside the area of halacha, so whether that be in the area of history or that be in the area of science, then we're not bound by what Chazal write in the same way that we are, with regard to areas of halacha. And this wasn't the first to say this, that you find this very much in the Gaonim, well before him, but this was certainly not the dominant strand in the Rishonim and in early, early modern Europe. In your more traditional communities, this became something that really becomes a flashpoint. As you do begin to have a rise of a Haskalah, and the Haskalah begins to focus its attention on a kind of a scientific, critical reading of our texts, they will look back at DeRossi and say, look, there was a traditional Jewish scholar, right, who was writing this way already back in the 16th century, and he becomes almost a hero in that community, and very much seen as suspect in the more traditional community. Now, in his time, it's interesting that there certainly does seem to have been backlash against him, at least in the period in the years following his life. There is a passage in the work of Rav Chaim David Azulay, his Machzik Bracha, which is a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, which cites a letter from 1574 from two students of the Mechaber that says that the work Ma'orei Naim deserves to be burnt. And perhaps most famously is that the Maharal spends numerous pages in his Be'er HaGola describing what he believes is the heresy of DeRossi, that this is not a work, that his treatment of Chazal is what he sees as tremendous disrespect and misunderstanding. He believes that there is tremendous, that is he being the Maharal, that there's tremendous esoteric meaning that DeRossi doesn't comprehend in the works of Chazal, and therefore he sees him as way too flippant in dismissing the certain writings of Chazal as rhetorical flourishes or hyperbole or ignorance. So there definitely was some rabbinic opposition to DeRossi early on, well before the Netziv. And we also understand why it reemerges later on when that kind of work becomes associated with people who have left the world of traditional Judaism. What's fascinating is that for the Nativ, there seems to be no compunction whatsoever using this work. Not just using it, but citing it and citing it at its most controversial. So the very places where De Rossi writes that these words of Chazal are not to be taken literally, right? Or that this is just, hyperbole, or even where Isaiah De Rossi is citing church fathers as his source for geographic information that he might have. Not only does the Nitziv cite it, but he says, go look at it. He says, go read it, right? I am Sefer Moreh and I am Eliezeria Domi, right? I am Sham. Go read it. Go read it for yourself. You can see exactly what he's doing. Getting back to our story from beforehand, this was the most amazing thing to me. Like the fact that this is just, it's all over the place. And once you see it, you also understand that even when he's not citing De Rossi, he's taking a very similar type of, hermeneutic approach to the work of Chazal. So he was deeply influenced by the work without question. But getting back to my story from before, it was, now the question was, well, was he alone? Was the Nitziv this renegade who had this, this copy of De Rossi that he was using? And the answer is no. Yehuda Leib Edel, who is the Maggid of Slonim, cites De Rossi. Rav Avram ben Agra cites De Rossi. The Maggid of Vilna, cites De Rossi on a number of occasions. It seems to have been a work where in early 19th century, amongst the center of Lithuanian scholarship, they didn't see the same kind of heretical tension in this work that those before him and those after him will certainly see.
Is it fair to say, therefore, that the early Nitziv vastly differed from the later Nitziv? And was that a result of the change that happened in Lithuanian Torah scholarship?
So I'd say yes and no. Right? Yes and no. So I think there's a change in the Nitziv and in his literary output from when he was a young man till to his later years of life. And that change, I think, is a reflection of the changes happening in society around him. So as I mentioned before, Emek HaNetziv is the earliest thing he wrote. Right? He never publishes it. And I don't think that's a coincidence. The work that he does publish, so this work is filled with references to the things he was writing, and the things that he does publish have none of these references in them, whatsoever. And I think that is a reflection of the fact that when he was writing Emek HaNetziv, he was a young guy. And he is a bachur in yeshiva, a bright one, and a well-connected one. But he doesn't have the responsibilities of anybody else, on his shoulders. He's not responsible for training anybody else. And so he writes what he thinks. He writes, he cites what he writes. He has no problem reading anything that's, that he thinks is valuable, discarding anything that he does. I think that once he becomes a Rosh Yeshiva, I think that the calculus is different. I think that he does feel a responsibility to be more careful with where he sends his readers, and to read what, to engage with what. And I think that's partially because the world around him has changed as well. So I noted that in the early 19th century, which he's very much a product of, even though he's only born in 1816, he comes on the, on the heels of that, but he's very much tied into that world. Haskalah is not a real threat. It's not a real threat to anybody in the traditional world of Torah learning in Lithuanian circles. By the middle of the 19th century, that changes, and it has found its own ground. There's a school for training modern rabbis that's founded in Vilna in 1848. There is government support behind that camp, and you begin to have intellectuals emerge, who will claim, like, the great poet Yehuda Leib Gordon, that you should be a Jew at home and a man in the street. And that's that's a threat. That's definitely a threat. So suggesting that people go learn Mendelssohn or go learn de Rossi has a different implication in the second half of the 19th century than it did in the first half. So his position has changed, and the world around him has changed as well. But all that having been said, we know that there were some really interesting people who came to learn in the Yeshiva of Elazığ in the second half of the 19th century, people like Chaim Nachman Bialik and Yosef Berdichevsky, people who would go on to distinguish careers well outside the world of traditional Judaism, people who were deep thinkers in a whole bunch of different ways. And what they all have in common is they all came to learn with the Netziv. You know, by the second half of the 19th century, the Netziv is giving shir, and then Chaim Soloveitchik is there as well, right? Reb Chaim Brisker was also giving shir, and they give very different shirim. They're very different people. They have a very close relationship, but they're very different people. And this type of student, and there were plenty of tremendous Talmidei Chachamim who learned with the Netziv as well. Rav Kook, Reb Chaim Ozer, many. But that type of student seems to be attracted to the Netziv, even in his later years, because there seems to be something that they sense, you know, about the way he writes and about the way he thinks and the way he's interested. And like I said before, it comes across in his Chumash Shiurim. It comes across. It's there in HaMikdavar. You can't take it out of him. He's just not citing it in the same way, perhaps not sending people to read it in the same way that he would have or did in his younger years.
You write in the book, it's kind of like a mystique, the manuscript of the Emek HaNetziv. So who holds that manuscript? You talk about limited access to it. What's the story behind that manuscript story?
Yeah, it's my Indiana Jones story. the story is simply, you know, as I was in this process of trying to verify that this was the earliest thing that he wrote, I needed to try and get my hands on the actual manuscript, because, you know, one of the great lessons I learned from Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik as an undergrad, you know, was that you can't take for granted that a book, that a printed work is what it purports to be. And especially a printed work that was printed in the 1950s, you know, that was clearly written, you know, almost 100 years earlier. Who knows what else could have gotten in there, whether what purports to be the writing of the Netziv is actually the writing of the Netziv. And much of that can't be verified without actually getting your hands on a manuscript. So that was a major goal of mine. And through various connections, I was, you know, Zvulun Harlap was a big help in that process. I was able to track down the manuscript as being held by descendants of the Netziv who lived in the Geula neighborhoods of Yerushalayim. There's a yeshiva, I don't even know if it's still around today, but it was called Yeshivas Volozh in Yerushalayim. That they were still, these are the descendants through of Rafael Shapiro. Rafael Shapiro marries the daughter of the Netziv. Rafael Shapiro's daughter marries Chaim Soloveitchik. So that's the tree of the family that has his manuscripts in their possession. And they were good enough to allow me to come and see. I think we had very different expectations as to what was going to happen during that meeting or series of meetings. I was a young graduate student at the time. I left my wife for the first time for a prolonged period of time to come to Israel, hoping that I was going to sit with these manuscripts for a number of days and work my way through them, and be able to determine what pieces seem to have been. There are multiple strands in this manuscript. You can see what's his earlier writing, what he added in afterwards, see if there was anything that was added by others, by looking at changes in handwriting. So I did get in to see them. The problem is that when they let me in, I was seated at a table. There were two other people at the table. There was this Rosh Hashiva of Yeshivas Volozh in Yerushalayim. There was, I believe it was his uncle. They had the manuscript in front of them. And they said to me, so what do you want to see? I'm like, well, what do I want to see? I don't want to see it all. I mean, that's what I was there to do. This is a three-volume work, and I was I was intending to sort of sit there, you know, happily at their living room, you know, at their dining room table, but to sit there and work through these various texts. And it was very clear to me very on that was not their conception of what was going to happen here, but rather I was going to tell them a particular passage that I wanted to see, and they were going to look at it, and then they were going to pass it over to me if it got their, you know, their approval that I could look at it. And, you know, that was a big disappointment for me. I did get to see it. I did get to see certain pieces. I got to see that they were very guarded around this manuscript. And I think particularly because of some of the citations that are in there, for example, the citation of Mendelssohn, which does not, you would never know that that's what it is in the printed text, because it's an abbreviation where one letter in the abbreviation is the wrong letter. And Moshe, abbreviation is, actually it doesn't even say Moshe. It says Perush Aleph, it's Chumash Taf Aleph. So Chumash Taf Aleph, something me bet ayin samech aleph. Point is that it's corrupted there in the printed text. The word is actually desau, not besau. And the reference is clearly to most Mendelssohn's parish on Chumash. And if you look up the place in his parish, it's exactly talking about what the Nativ is talking about there. But that citation is underlined in pink in the manuscript. So they know that it was there, right? They were certainly aware of that. And I think there was a little bit of, you know, a fear over what I would do with this text and what it might do to the image and the legacy of the Nativ if I, you know, spread it too far. And so unfortunately I got to glimpse at a couple of pages. They were nice enough actually to make a copy of a few of the pages for me. So just so that I could be able to explain how, you know, what the text looked like and how he clearly changed and edited his text over the years. But there was a lot I didn't get to see, unfortunately.
Right. Well, we can go on and on. I think our time is up again. The pillar from the Talis Vihuda Berlin, the world of 19th century Lithuanian Torah scholarship. Rabbi Dr. Pearl, this has been absolutely fascinating. And again, urge our viewers and listeners to simply go on and purchase the book. And thank you so much for your time. It's really most appreciated. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.